It is okay, even healthy, to lose a deal. And that frequently you have to lose a deal twice to win it once. And I love when I see that second deal don't close lost, because I'm like, I know exactly where you're focusing in two quarters. And take everything you've learned, because you're going to win it next time and you're going to win it big. Previously closed lost deals have become a huge channel for us, because that first closed lost deal is just education. And that enables us to close an even bigger deal when they're ready to buy.
Welcome to another episode of GoToMarket Mavericks, the podcast about go-to-market innovators, risk takers, and leaders, and the unique strategies and tactics they use to succeed. Today, I'm excited to welcome onto the show Eleanor Dorfman, who currently leads all things sales at Retool, which helps technical teams build apps quickly and easily, minimizing time spent on mundane tasks so they can focus on the work that matters. Prior to her role at Retool, she did tours of duty across a variety of functions, including operations, customer success, and has even spent a little bit of time in venture. Eleanor, I'm excited to have you on today.
Great, thanks for having me. I was living in New York, working at the New York City Department of Education, managing a middle school literacy initiative, where we were working to have eighth graders graduate middle school reading on grade level. And I worked with about 50 middle schools rolling out literacy software and software for teachers training, and ran into a lot of infrastructure challenges where I couldn't get students' accounts, so that because so many students were in and out every day that you couldn't just send one export at the beginning of the year. You needed a near daily sync to ensure every student who entered a middle school or switched classes had access to the software they needed to improve their literacy skills. And I was looking for a solution to that infrastructure challenge, and found a startup that was solving that problem. And I thought it would be more fun to work at a startup in my 20s than being like a mid-level bureaucrat. They disagreed, and probably because I called an API an appy in the interview and thought I didn't have any of the relevant skills. So I convinced them to hire me as an unpaid intern, and moved across the country and moved in with my mom's college roommate, Joan, in San Mateo, and worked as an unpaid intern at a startup called Clever for a few months before they brought me on full time. And so Clever is where I really fell in love with working in tech and sort of realized what made me passionate professionally. And so ended up at Clever. When I left, I was running customer success and pre and post sales engineering, and went over to Segment, which is also middleware and infrastructure. And I like companies and products that change the way something operates. So Clever changed the way school districts operate. If you have kids in elementary school or middle school, they're usually using Clever to log in and to use their software, which is really cool. And Segment changes the way company ops operate. And at Segment, I had a few different roles. I was in customer success operations, ended up launching a few new sales teams. I worked on renewals, expansion sales. And after Segment's acquisition, I knew that I wanted to do another early stage company and really go build. And I was looking for a company that was a technical product that solved technical problems, but also business problems. And when you solve both, you have an opportunity to attach to really important initiatives. You get to attach to power. You get to work across an organization. And if it's an open-ended platform, it's a really fun intellectual puzzle, because there's no way to build a playbook that's just, they say this, you say this, they say this, you say this, you attach to this budget line item, and then you click go, and you have these three value props, and you solve this very clear problem. With a product like Retool, sales is just is really interesting, because there's an infinite number of use cases, and there's an infinite number of buyers, and an infinite number of ways people can use the platform. And so it's never boring. And from day one, it has been figure out what works right now. What's the right profile? What's the right approach? What's the right playbook? Okay, now it looks different. And like, our sales team has really gotten the opportunity to reinvent itself so many times as we have grown and scaled as a company. So I fell in love with the product, and that's why I've been here for the last 4 years.
Funny enough, your story and my story are to some extent a little bit aligned, at least at the outset. I was on my way to probably the middle of nowhere, Mississippi. Nothing against Mississippi, but every state has a middle of nowhere, and that's where I was headed to do Teach for America. I was going to go teach high school math, and then I got a call from a buddy working out in San Mateo at a developer tools company, a database company called Neo4j, and I ultimately decided with strong pushes from my significant other at the time to join that company. And we did, and the rest is history. But so I took a right turn where you took a left at the very beginning, and I circumvented a stint in education. But nonetheless, very interesting backstory. I loved hearing about your perspective on selling and kind of enabling sellers on broader products or more complex products. What would you say differentiates sellers of more complex products versus if you're a seller with a more point solution offering?
I think anyone can do both. It's a matter of what you like and what keeps you engaged, because sales can be really isolating. It can be really emotional. It's a roller coaster. The highs are really high. The lows are really low. Sometimes they happen within the same hour, the same day. You reset every 90 days. Like, sales is hard. And I think in the last 4 years, it's been a crazy environment in tech and in sales in particular. I think people who excel at an open-ended product are people who have more of a product sensibility and want to get really deep in the product and aren't intimidated by it and can deeply understand what life looks like without it and want to go see, like, I want to watch someone build a React app so I can truly grasp at every stage and develop the conviction of why this product, like what it abstracts away and why that matters. And I think there's a certain mindset of someone who just wants to go really, really deep on that. And some people really like products that they use in their day-to-day life so they can truly internalize the value prop. This is one where, as an AE, you're not going to be able to internalize the value prop quite as much unless you're very intentional about going out and doing that. So I think that's a huge one. I think curiosity about the different types of businesses, like the ability to want to go really deep on understanding, okay, what do manufacturing companies care about the most? Okay, they have this, they care about the supply chain, they care about demand forecasting, they care about all of these things that might not resonate with my day-to-day, but like a really high curiosity, high deal situational awareness. I think with an open-ended, more complex product, you got to have your head on a swivel in a deal at all the times, because you have to be like, all right, am I going bottoms up here? Am I attaching to the right initiative? Does this person have power? You're champion testing all the time because the strength of your champion matters so much more. So I think a desire to build a really, really strong relationship is extremely important. And do you find that fun? Like, do you enjoy the intellectual puzzle of all of these deals are going to look a little different? That can be exhausting if it's not something that gets you excited and up in the morning. So I think enjoying that type of sale is a certain type of masochism, but is definitely a big part of being successful.
You were talking about the multiple facets of a deal, right? When you're in a more complex sale, there's multiple champions that you got to track down. You got to know your buyers. How do your teams keep track of all of those potential buyers and that buying unit? What are some of the approaches you've seen the best reps use and your teams use to keep track of and keep tabs on all of the different buyers that they have to stay on top of in a complex deal?
It's actually with Retool, it's interesting. You have your builders. So you have the people that are going in and building Retool apps every day and building workflows and building apps. You have your buyers. So the people that usually maybe have an admin role, but really just care about the outputs, what's being built, what kind of efficiency is it driving. You have your end users. So frequently, like, we have customers that have built like 1,100 applications. So there's applications that are used by HR. They don't care about the building experience, like, but they're the ones who are ultimately getting a lot of the benefits. So it's triangulating your end users, so people in HR and sales, on the data analytics team, on the support team, on the success teams. You've got your builders that are typically engineers or just a more technical analyst or like a data analyst or a RevOps analyst or something like that. And then you've got your buyers, typically a CTO or CIO, a VP of engineering, a head of IT, head of enterprise architecture, things like that. So it's actually really multifaceted because you have to try. And then as the deal size expands within an account, all of those characters can shift. And that's pretty common in most types of SaaS sales. So in terms of tactics, I have seen some of the most beautiful org. You have to have an org chart for everything. You've got to know who are your builders, who are your buyers, who are your champions, who are your detractors, who's still suspicious, who might see you as a threat. We'll do a lot of weekly, bi-weekly account team reviews for the most complex ones, where we've just got a deck we'll maintain of like current engagements, future engagements, status of current activation, status of current adoptions, status of active POCs, key stakeholders. We generate account plans and do quarterly account reviews from Salesforce, where we're tracking everything programmatically. And so you have to, for the really complex ones, you have to have a lot of structure and organization and project management around it, because at any given time, you could be managing multiple POCs, multiple deployments, multiple teams, multiple champions, but then have your head on, okay, in 18 months, am I going to consolidate these? Like, you still have to always have a very clear North Star that you're building towards. And that is a huge part of the fun, and why I think these selling a product like Retool is so fun, because you get to think current state, short-term, medium, long-term, all the time. When you're selling your first deal, you always have an eye towards, what am I going to do in 6 months, in 12 months, in 18 months? And you get to think that way and think strategically about how this could serve the entire company, because you're selling a platform that has the possibility and the ability to serve and impact everyone at a company. And there aren't a lot of products where that's the case.
There's a lot of behavior that you need to kind of keep track of at like the human and like the org level, where they're priority shifting, all those things, right? Some call these, you know, behavioral shifts signals, some call them triggers, some just call them, you know, there's a host of different words you could use for them. And if you're to cut the funnel into like a binary state of, you know, the opportunity has been created, right? Like whether it's a, you know, the handoff has been made to sales and then pre-handoff, right? So your prospecting stages and then your sales-led stages. What are some of the signals, even across the entire thing, those two buckets, that your team is kind of clued into at the person and organizational level that are really important for your team to stay on top of? It would be my first question. And I have a follow-up, which is like, hey, how do you keep track of those right now? But yeah, we'd love to hear your perspectives on that.
So we have a really amazing RevOps team, and they have built this, what I think could be a SaaS company, but they've built this object, I guess is probably the right word, called journeys, because exactly what you said, there are so many touch points, especially in an enterprise deal where we might meet three people in an event, meet another two people at another event. We have five people over here kicking the tires on our free plan. We have three people over here looking at our docs. We have two people over here who attended a webinar, and we have one person over here who used Retool at a previous company and has just joined this enterprise company. We probably have three closed lost opportunities of what we tried to sell to them in the past. We've had a BDR reaching out to 10 to 15 different people. We've served them LinkedIn ads. They've read three pieces of content, and maybe they've attended a webinar. But it is a journey to get to a sales qualified opportunity, and every single one of those touch points matters. So with this journey object, we're able to actually track all of that within the journey across all of the different contacts inside of a company. And that part is critical, because there are so many touch points you need to get to a qualified opportunity with an open-ended product, where you have to have the right champion, the right use case. Like, we call them an anchor use case, because ultimately you're selling a platform and you want to be able to sell the ability to solve operational efficiency at a huge scale, but you still need something very tangible to start with. So you need the right anchor use case. You need to attach the right initiative so you can have the right compelling event. And you need to have a champion who can really function as a change agent inside of the organization. And getting to that is a journey. And so the key signals are, usually you've had some practitioner level folks tick the tires. Maybe they've played around with the free plan. You want to see some folks at a higher level showing some interest in doing some research. Maybe they've looked at our pricing page. And you want to see someone who's shown active intent in thinking about deployment. So maybe they're looking at our self-hosted docs. Maybe they're doing that tried and true sales technique and they're looking at SAML. So you know that they're an enterprise buyer. And maybe they've looked on G2, or they've looked on Gartner's Magic Quadrant, or they've done a little research. And usually they've come by the booth. We've scanned someone at reInvent or at the Databricks Summit or the Snowflake Summit or something like that. So it is some combination of building and orchestration, administration level intent, and then a level of education on the product, either through attending a webinar, seeing us at a conference, or reading some of our content.
What are some of the best ways that you've seen reps utilizing and implementing that type of intelligence in their sales motion, either pre-opportunity or post-opportunity when they're working a deal?
All of the above. We have a training we use and we talk about inbox zero on that. So you're up to date every single day on your intent signals. You know who's been looking at the website. You know where champions have been moving in and out. You're looking at your trial signups. You're looking at who's attended webinars. And you're keeping track of all of that day in and day out. And you'll get notified of a trial signup. You'll get notified when someone's hitting the tires. And folks really are very disciplined and build a really complete picture of what's going on in their account. So they'll know that a new BU is kicking the tires over here, and they'll triangulate between power over here and practitioner over here. And sometimes our reps will know a lot more about what's going on inside of an organization than our buyers will, because they're able to see across all the different BUs that are kicking the tires. So folks are building really thorough pre-opportunity account plans of knowing which teams they're targeting, knowing where they've seen these intent signals, and harnessing those to go after them. And we think about it in sort of three ways. Active intent, where someone comes in, requests a demo, has a use case, has done their research. And then it's just harnessing that and driving that towards close. We have passive intent, which the reps have gotten really strong at, where there's been some level of intent, but there's no, they're not clicking the button, but they've been attending webinars, attending events, they've spun up a free account, they've been reading the docs, and that's where reps go out to them with a hypothesis and an opinion and are able to harness that passive intent and turn that into an active opportunity. And then there's latent intent, where we know we can solve their problem, but maybe they're not educated on retool, maybe they don't have a use case yet. And that's a bit of a longer game, and that's where they'll sit down with their BDR and they'll map out a plan. And these are the teams we want to go after. These are the events we want to invite them to. Let's see if we have any exec overlap and anyone we can reach out to. Let's see if we can look at similar companies. How do they leverage retool? How can we go to them with a hypothesis and an opinion on the problems we can solve? And there's sort of patterns and different plays that exist within those three buckets that the reps have built very repeatable playbooks around.
Just go back in your career, right? Like going back to the beginning of your career till now, what are the key trends that you're seeing in the market in terms of like availability and access to this information then versus now?
You can have so much access to information now. You can understand someone's tool stack. You have access to all the intent data. You're able to stitch it all together in a way that's really powerful, so you can see the complete picture of who's attending your events. Are these the same people who are looking at your website? What companies are they from? Where did they work before? Did they use retool before? And you're able to build such a complete picture so that you as a seller can come in and speak their language and have a hypothesis and have an opinion. And so I think the ability to understand, are they looking at Gartner? Are they looking at G2? Are they using your competitors? What other tools are they using? The ability to co-sell with other companies so that you can triangulate and org nav a lot more freely is all stuff. It's just changed. It used to be very Arctic outbound, and you'd hit the phones and you'd have to send 18 emails and did 18 touches in front of five different people over the course of 6 months in order to get a response. Whereas now I think you can, it's way more about this sort of inbound outbound motion where it's all, which is why I've, instead of thinking about it purely as inbound and outbound, it's, we're thinking about it more as active, passive, and latent, because that passive bucket used to be one that you couldn't attack in the way that you can now. And now that's such an incredible source of pipeline.
Yeah, it's like the visibility up funnel, and now you can really take prescriptive action on that passive intent that wasn't necessarily available to you in the past.
Exactly. Like it's not just completely cold outreach. It's, okay, I've got enough signal where I can come to you with a pretty educated outbound, and where I love when a prospect is like, wow, you just read my mind. How did you know that? And you're like, well, it's of just some light internet stalking and a deeply creepy approach, but it's effective.
So be creepy, but don't get blocked is the advice. Okay.
Walk right up to the line.
Up to that. Yeah, to the line. I love it. So something that's pretty consistent in your experience is working with tools that are end user driven, right? Whether it's retool, segment, and you have a product led motion to some extent tied to it. I know that maybe it's not as much the rage as it was, I don't know, 2 to 3 years ago during the Zerp days. But
I miss those PLG,
days. Yes. Don't we all, right? In many ways, they were much easier times. I'd love to hear your perspective on product product-led sales, it's a term that's come up, you know, even after the rise of PLG. We'd love to understand maybe some of the successes and pitfalls you've seen when your teams or others have tried to implement product-led sales.
I think it looks totally different at every company. It's highly dependent on, you know, what percent of your business is self-serve, what percent is sales-led. And so I think that really matters. At Segment, it was 90-10. At Retool, it's like 85-15. There are a lot of companies where it's completely reversed, and I think it looks really different. So I think first, that ratio really matters. Second is, what is the role of self-service? Is it a lead channel? Is it a standalone plan that they can exist on forever? Is it trying to capture a certain part of the TAM? Is it trying to just build brand awareness? Is it, there can be so many different things, and I think that really informs the perspective as well. And so I think those two things really matter. And then what type of product do you have? Is it one that someone can use really independently, or is it one where you need multiple people involved? So in order for that PLG motion to be successful, you need some viral loops in there. And it, so it looks really different. At Retool and Segment, it's fairly similar in terms of the ratio and in terms of, it's a great tool for brand awareness, especially when you're selling to a technical audience who might not want to talk to sales until they've been able to do some education on their own. And it's a great channel for capturing part of the TAM. And so to ensure, one of the big themes of the last few years that I think has sort of dovetailed with this emphasis and sort of the rise and fall of PLG, but has been consistent, is sales efficiency has become more of a top line metric than maybe it used to be in the past. And having a strong self-service motion is a huge contributor to sales efficiency. So it can capture a part of the TAM where it might not be worth it to pay marketing to go to the lead, to pay a BDR to go to the lead, to pay a rep and an SE and a manager and a manager's manager and a sales engineering manager as well, where that payback, it just isn't there. And so I think it's really valuable as a way for folks to kick the tires, as a way for them to get started, especially with a product like Retool, where they can experiment and play around and get comfortable, and they can do their own discovery to figure out what's the most applicable use case within their organization. They can send it to different folks. And then when they're ready to use us at scale or in production, we're able to come in and either move them to an enterprise plan or get them started with enterprise, but they've been able to do a lot of that discovery and education up front. And then also it's valuable in taking and serving a big part of the market that it doesn't make sense from an overall business perspective for the sales team to serve. And it's enabled our sales team to stay leaner longer and to focus on maximizing the productive capacity and the output of the sales team. And for us to be able to scale in a way where it isn't linear and we're not necessarily like, okay, we need to grow this amount, let's throw three more bodies at it. We're able to say, okay, let's think about, is self-serve going to serve this part? So how can we maximize the impact of humans more and more?
For those who are not running this motion, or even maybe for those who are and are probably struggling, what are some of the key partnerships within the organization that you really need to forge as a sales leader? If you're beginning to run this motion or are running it and you're finding maybe like the gears aren't turning the way they need to.
Oh, I mean, you need to be in lockstep with product and marketing. And the biggest thing is you all need to have the same answer for what is the role of self-service. And you need to have a framework for, like, if you're a high quality team, you're shipping a lot, you're building new features, you're listening to your customers, you're constantly evolving the roadmap, and having a framework for, okay, which plan should this belong to? Pricing and packaging just is a constant topic, and it should be. And it should be always trying to like seek the truth. What's the why of this functionality? What's the role of this? What's the problem we're trying to solve here? Does it make sense to go in this plan or this plan? Okay, great. And you get a lot of leverage on the marketing side around those launches. So how do we get those launch moments right? What's the sign-up goal? And then also what's the SQO goal? And so to develop a framework on how do we think about sign-ups, all like a corporate sign-up all the way through to a sales qualified opportunity. And what does that funnel look like for your business? Because it's going to look different for everyone. And that ideal breakdown is going to depend on your ratio of self-service to sales, to direct sales revenue, and what that relationship looks like in between. So it's, and it's also getting the metrics right with finance. How do you want to incentivize upselling to self-service? How do you want to set that up in comp plans? How do you want to incentivize the person who owns self-service? Is it revenue-based or is it sign-up-based or is it activity and adoption-based? And so it's actually, I take back what I said, it's marketing, it's product, and it's finance, because everyone needs to be on the same page about the targets, the incentive structure, and the role of each of these parts of the business and in the funnel.
Have you found that having a strong partnership with finance and getting that piece of the puzzle figured out helps in terms of putting to bed some of the concerns from maybe more your concerned sales rep who says, hey, self-serve seems to be competing with me. Or I think there's like, to some extent, there's like a healthy friction there. And that there's can turn unhealthy if there isn't a clear line.
It helps with that, but that's always going to be a tension. And there, it's brutal if you've done a lot of work and you lose a deal to self-serve. So a lot of that is getting the incentives right. When do you want to bake self-serve into comp plans? How do you think about that relationship? When you're setting targets, you're always looking at that historical data, knowing that there's going to be some percentage that's going to go with self-serve. So that relationship with finance is incredibly important there, because it's all about, it's all relative. Like if you get the targets right, if you're looking at the funnel, if you're all on the same page about it, then it's a great thing to lose to self-serve, because it means they're going to be a nurture customer and they're going to buy. And it's just pipe gen for 2 quarters out. And you always do need to be thinking about current quarter, next quarter. And so getting the incentives and the framework right so that you're not losing to self-service. It's just a nurture account that's going to be probably an even bigger deal than it would have been because they're educated, because they're adopted, because you'll have a champion, because you'll have someone who's already gained some benefit from the product. You'll have a much deeper understanding of the problems you can solve. And it's ultimately then will be a much faster close when they're ready. It's just a longer timeline up front.
Where do you think commercial conversation should be happening within an organization? I've seen it, you know, both ways where, hey, I've seen it where the CSMs take it. I've seen it where the AEs take it. I'm curious to hear your perspective on this.
Yeah. And I've worked in pre and post sales. So my first tech job was actually as a CSM. And then have led ops teams and renewals teams. And so I'm very much believe in the school of thought of strong opinions weakly held. So I'm always happy to be and excited to be proven wrong because it means you're growing. But my strong perspective is that commercial conversations need to live within the sales org. And a lot of my team doesn't love this, but I do believe renewals need to be within the sales org, because when you have a commercial target, when you own a forecast, when you own a number, that's always going to be the dominant thing. It's measurable. It's going to be part of your performance management. Your customer is going to care a lot about it. It's going to be this very tangible focal point. And it's ultimately going to be the thing that always pulls your attention. And if you have a number, it is very hard to balance caring about adoption at the level that you need to care to drive the results that you need to drive. And if you have any sort of commercial target, that's going to be your North Star. And so that is always, a sales team is always going to have a commercial target. And so I believe they should also own renewals, and that all commercial targets need to live within the sales team. Because for a success team to achieve what it needs to achieve, there can't be distractions. It has to be adoption. And adoption is always going to be your leading indicator for expansion. And NDR is one of the most important metrics right now, because there's so much noise and competition for buyers' attention. And if you can't renew and grow an account, then you're just refilling a leaky bucket over and over again. And that expansion is so much cheaper, it's so much faster, and it's ultimately so much more valuable if you can build that LTV number up and up and up. But you cannot get there if someone doesn't wake up every morning and go to bed every night thinking about adoption. Because if they have a commercial target, they will not think about adoption as their most important thing. And it needs to be what someone cares the most about.
What's some of the pushback you've seen? And I know this, your reps may at some point get a hold of this, so you know, feel free to share what you will. But like, what's some of the pushback you've typically seen when you've implemented this approach, assuming you've implemented? How have you responded to that pushback?
Well, there's pushback on everything. Like, so it's, for me, it's, if you're going to own the upside, you own the downside as well. And I think if you're not thinking about everything from the perspective of the entire customer life cycle, you're going to make short-sighted decisions. And fundamentally, it just comes down to that. And so the pushback is, it's tough to own downside. There's already in sales so much that's outside of your control. And that becomes even more real when you're talking about implementation. A company might go out of business. Your champion might leave the company. Maybe you're working with a PS partner that drops the ball and you end up in a churn safe situation. Maybe a company gets acquired and suddenly their business metrics change and their business goals change. Maybe they have a budget freeze. Maybe they go through a RIF. It just takes what is already the hardest part of sales, which is learning to control what you can control and how to manage all the exogenous factors that have a very real impact on your livelihood. And then that's 10x'd when you also own a renewals number. And so it's just figuring out, again, how do you get the structures right so that you can give folks the opportunity to control as much as possible? How do you get that teaming right for the account team with pre and post sales and support and professional services? How do you set up the incentives so you feel that it's fair and it's hard, but it's fair and it's achievable? How do you set up the ROE so that you have as few exceptions as possible, so that you don't spend time litigating internal disputes and you spend time focusing on the customer and outputs? And then you have to be willing to iterate because you're going to mess it up and you're going to learn from it. And it's finding that blend of structure and forgiveness so that you can scale consistently, objectively, that it can be standardized across the team so that everyone does feel it's fair. And it's being upfront when you did it wrong, but being high conviction when you know you've gotten it right.
One more question on this very specific topic. If you're adding, I'm an account executive. I now own renewals and expansions. I also own my net new business. In some organizations, AEs are also expected to then like prospect, right? Like that's a responsibility. At some point, people hit human limits of capacity constraints. Like, what are some of the things you're doing to help the team, get through those capacity constraints? Or I'm just curious how you're working through the challenges there.
That is the job of a sales leader and a revenue leader and a RevOps team, is how do you make the AE as productive as possible? How do you remove as much as you can through process, through tooling, through getting the right supporting functions in place? Sometimes it's renewals managers. Sometimes it's splitting it out into AEs and AMs and having a hunter-farmer model. It's having a deal desk function that takes things off their plate. It's constantly looking, and it's learning from your team. Like in our QBRs, in our quarterly business reviews, we have an ask of the business. And we, at the beginning of next QBR season, we go through the previous quarter's ask of the business. What did we, and I always joke, there's always one theme that emerges every quarter where everyone's like, this is killing me. You need to fix this now. But your team will tell you, and they will have better ideas than you will. And so a lot of it is just being receptive and knowing that so much of my job is to block and tackle and move as much out of their way as possible. And when they hit constraints, be open to rethinking the org structure, but always doing it with an eye towards, what problem am I solving? Is this the right problem? Am I trying to unblock them? Am I trying to make sure they can take on more? Do I want to take this piece off their plate and put some specialists there? And as you scale, you're going to build more and more specialization. So it'll start out with, full cradle to grave, womb to tomb, everything. And then you start to build in specialization. And it starts with BDRs, and then it's CSMs or technical account managers. And then it's PS, and then it's a deal desk, and then it's renewals managers. And then maybe it's inside sales, and then maybe it's a junior rep assigned to support a senior rep. But as you get larger, you start to take more and more off and build that specialization. It's just about doing it at the right times. And when you're doing it, knowing why you're doing it and what metric you're trying to move with that decision.
So what's one thing that you've learned over time, or something that you've done over time, that you don't think other revenue leaders have learned or done to some extent, that has yielded outsized results for you and your teams?
Oh, I just think I still have so much to learn that I always struggle answering questions like that. And there's, again, it's stuff that's going to look different at every company. I have an old boss and mentor who said to me once, you never let your internal processes impact the customer experience. And that's something that I've really internalized and think a lot about, because it's such a pressure cooker of a job. It's so easy to want to externalize the pressure you're under and you're feeling. And it's really important to always remember that you're nothing without your customers, and that no matter what's happening and internally, it should be as smooth as possible an experience for them. And that if that is something that you hold sacred, you're going to make the right decision more often than not. So I would say that's a big one. And then with an open-ended sort of product-led motion like Retool, it's that it is okay, even healthy, to lose a deal. And that frequently you have to lose a deal twice to win it once. And I love when I see that second deal go close lost, because I'm like, I know exactly where you're focusing in two quarters. And take everything you've learned, because you're going to win it next time and you're going to win it big. And that, and so previously closed loss deals have become a huge channel for us, because that first closed loss deal is just education. And then they know what Retool does. And then they go into that, they go from that cold and that latent intent into that passive intent. Because then the next time they inevitably run into some operational hurdle inside of their company, they'll have Retool top of mind and say, hey, can we build a Retool app to solve that? Could Retool workflows solve that? Could we build a portal to solve that? And that enables us to close an even bigger deal when they're ready to buy.
I appreciate all of the insights you've shared so far today, Eleanor. How do people get in touch with you? And you know, where are you active? Or are you a recluse? Let us know. How do we get in touch with you?
I have no social media except for LinkedIn. So LinkedIn, Eleanor Dorfman at Retool. And then it's Eleanor at Retool.com. Otherwise, that's really it. I'm a LinkedIn daily active user, as you need to be always recruiting in my job. So it's where I spend a lot of my time. But that's the best way to find me.
Please reach out to her. She's got a wealth of insights, clearly. And with that, that's another episode of Go To Market Mavericks.
Thank you.